following presentation is brought to you by Faith Presbyterian Church Reformed. Delivering today's message will be Dr. Richard Bacon.
Well, this is just, I'm calling it part four. Up until now, we haven't called it the Almighty and the Dollar. I think we've called it husbanding wealth or the biblical view of wealth or something like that. But basically, what we've got this time actually is the biblical view of wealth. Going back several months to the last time we talked on this subject, the last one was called something like socialism and envy. Does that ring a bell with anybody? And we were again both, right? Okay, did we come down on one side or the other on that? No, we were against socialism and we were against envy. And we looked at what envy really is and what it's claiming to be. Now, this is part four, the biblical view of wealth. What is wealth? How does it come about? How can we preserve it? Although we're not going to talk very much about preserving it. That's for a future time. I want to look at five things this afternoon, five things under the biblical view of wealth. First of all, I want us to look at four pertinent and foundational facts. These are four certainties, four biblical, I almost want to say absolutes, that we must understand if we're going to understand the biblical view of wealth. So four pertinent and foundational facts. Then we're going to look at how wealth is produced, scripturally speaking, biblically speaking, and Christian historically speaking. Then third, we're going to look specifically at the 16th century Reformation. How many of you can remember from a year ago when the 16th century Reformation was? How many of you said 16th century? You got it right. The 16th century Reformation was the one that we celebrated last October. You remember 1517? And we're going to see how the 16th century Reformation view of Scripture, of God, of man, of these four pertinent foundational facts, how the Reformation view basically opened up Western civilization. What we know today as Western civilization is really Reformation civilization. We don't live in the medieval times, and the reason we don't is because the Reformation took place. If we still lived under a medieval concept of Christianity, all the wealth would be trapped in the church and the fiefdoms, and we would all be serfs. And that's got nothing to do with the internet, by the way. And then finally, I want to talk about prophets and what prophets are. And I want to look at it both from an economic standpoint and from an accounting standpoint, because what accountants mean by prophets and what economists mean by prophets is not necessarily the same thing. What an accountant means by prophet is basically surplus. What an economist means by profit is surplus after subtracting future investments. In other words, you can't eat the seed corn and you can't sell the seed corn. You have to plant the seed corn. So even though it's a surplus, it doesn't count as a surplus or doesn't count as a profit as far as the economist is concerned. Then the last thing I want to do is just pull it all together for you in one easy to copy frame. So four pertinent basics. Here's the first basic, and this is just on the first page of Scripture. Who can tell me what is the first statement Scripture makes? In the beginning, what? God created heaven and earth. God, our Creator, is a creative being. That's number one. God is a creator. Say, well, what's that got to do with wealth? You'll see. Just get it in your notes right now. God, our Creator, is creative. Now, He did work in creation. 6 days of creation, right? How many of you know how long those 6 days were? Yeah, roughly 24 hours. Day one may have been 36, but certainly no more than that. See, why would I say that day one may have been 36? Because the first act of creation is let there be light. Then the evening and the morning were the first day. So we may have day, evening, day on the first day, which would be 36 hours. But that's speculative. It was no more than 36 hours. It's not like that means it was 100 kajillion years. Okay, so not only did He work in creation those first 6 days, He continues to work personally, governing and supervising everything that comes to pass. Means He didn't just blow on things and quit. He continues to work in providence. We call that providence. How many of you remember that from a year ago? He continues to work in providence. Pertinent fact number two. Pertinent and foundational. Fact number two. Man is created in God's image. Not in the sense of being autonomous. Autonomous means a law to itself. Man is not a law to himself, is he? He's not created in God's image in that respect, but we have personality. God has personality. Trees don't have personality. Rocks don't have personality. We think. Rocks don't think. Trees don't think. Even dogs don't think. I know some of you have dogs, but that's conditioned response. They're not thinking. And we talk and we dream. I don't mean dream at night. I mean we have plans and purposes. And most importantly, with respect to the moral image of God, we make choices. Yeah, that's going to become foundational when it comes to how we invest and how we make wealth, how we increase our wealth, how we profit. One of the ways we do that is by making choices. We're going to continue talking about man being created in God's image. The fact that we make choices explains why we are called moral beings. A rock is not a moral being. A tree is not a moral being. Even a dog is not a moral being because they don't make choices. So we are the image of God in this moral sense. And because we are in the image of God as moral beings, the nature of our choices leads to right and wrong choices. Okay, did you follow that? We got just a little bit tertiary there, a little bit secondary and then tertiary. But because we make choices, that's an indication that we're moral beings. Another indication that we're moral beings, or the result of being a moral being, is this, that our choices have to do with right and wrong, good and bad, evil and righteousness. Okay. This further implies that our choices must be governed by standards of right and wrong. To say that a choice is a right choice means that there must be some standard that governs that choice. Does that make sense? So go down here to the corner and turn west. Say, well, now, in order for me to turn west, I happen to think that that way is west. And somebody says, well, no, dummy, that's north. Say, well, in your world, that's north, but I like to call it west. We cannot do that with right and wrong. Something is either right or it's wrong according to a standard. Now, you know what the standard is, right? And the reason I say, do you know what the standard is this. As sinners, we don't always apply the right standard. Because we're sinners, saved by grace, but we're still sinners, saved by grace, we sometimes apply the wrong standard. So, to be a properly functioning image of God, man is required to live in obedience to his Creator. That means that my choices and my determinations of right and wrong must be according to the standard of God's law, the standard of God's commandments. By way of example, the first man and first woman, Adam and Eve, were forbidden to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. On what basis were they forbidden to eat of that tree? Was it just they wouldn't grow strong and tall and have good calcium in their bones? Why were they forbidden? Because God said so. That's the whole reason. Because God said so. And then, even the image of God then. And understand that Adam and Eve were certainly the image of God, just as we are certainly the image of God. Even the image of God is not allowed to do anything he wishes, but must live within the limitations imposed by God. There are certain laws that God has given, both of a moral nature and some would say of a natural law nature, although I maintain that what most of us call natural laws is really God's covenant with nature, God's covenant with creation. But we have to live within those limits. That's why economics has sometimes been called the dismal science. Have you ever heard it called the dismal, D-I-S-M-A-L, dismal science before? Well, here's why it's called the dismal science. It's because there's never as much as you want. So economics is the study, I want to call it a science, but it's not a science. It's a study of how we go about getting some of what we'd like to have, of how a society goes about allocating its resources. And we believe in a socialistic way of allocating resources, central planning, communism. We believe in freedomnomics, free enterprise, laissez-faire. Man was given further instructions by God as to the nature of his mission on earth. So when God tells us something about our mission on earth, it's generally by way of commandment. So for instance, be fruitful and multiply. So the way that we increase economically, the way we profit economically, includes the commandment to be fruitful and multiply. Now, does that mean that you're supposed to have 12 children? No. It means that if God blesses you with 14, you're supposed to have 14 children, or 17. And I've heard this argument. In fact, I heard this argument recently being made by someone who's not a member of this church, but he was in this church. Some of you remember this taking place in the men's meeting, that, in my country, he said, people are just so poor they can't afford 17 children. And you remember the question I asked him? Yeah, so how many children were there in your family? Seven. Okay, seven children. So then God is able to provide for seven children. That's a given. Since he grew up in a family with seven children, we know that God can provide for seven children in that culture, right? His claim is God can't provide for a family with 17 children. So the question I asked him was this: what's the number of children you have to have before God quits providing for you? And that number doesn't exist, does it? It doesn't exist in his society. It doesn't exist in our society. The commandment is, be fruitful and multiply. Man, if you can't afford to have more children, then obey the next commandment, which is, fill the earth and have dominion. As you take dominion of the earth, you know what's going to happen? You're going to be able to feed those mouths that have been multiplying in your home. Stop and think about this. Tell me one other thing besides children that Americans don't want more of. They want more lands, they want more houses, they want more cars, they want more clothes, they want more vacations, they want more boats,
some even want more taxes.
More taxes, more debt. Yeah. Americans want more of everything except the one thing God said I want everybody to have more of. Say, well, you know, I'm past my childbearing years. I don't know. Maybe you are. God will decide if you are or not. Now, since man was created with work as part of his purpose, we find a great measure of our fulfillment in our work. And if you don't find fulfillment in your work, then either you're not doing the right kind of work, or you need to study more about Reformed manhood. You need to find fulfillment in your work. Now, I don't know how a person can find fulfillment in tightening down the number 9 bolt all day long on an assembly line. I just can't imagine a person finding fulfillment in that. But here's what my advice is, tightening down that number 9 bolt. If you can't find fulfillment in that, start tightening down the number 10 bolt, then the number 11 bolt, until finally you're out the end of the assembly line and doing something that you can find fulfillment in doing. If you're not being fulfilled in the work that you're doing, then that is probably not your calling. And we're going to come to calling when we come to the 16th century Reformation. But for now, understand that we are supposed to find purpose in our calling just as Adam found purpose in his calling. So man was given further instructions by God as to the nature of his mission on earth. This deep desire that men have to work is a part of our hardwiring. How many of you have ever heard of a workaholic? Okay, I'm not sure what that is exactly. I know there is such a thing as a workaholic. I think it's a person who wants to avoid being around his family, so he spends all his time away at the office. But a workaholic does not mean that you work too much. A man finds fulfillment. Here's one way you can find out if a man is finding fulfillment in his work. Okay, I'm about to tell some stories out of school. Here's one of the ways you can tell. If you come home from work and you're angry and upset and nervous and just a terrible person to be around, you're not finding fulfillment in your work. Does that stand to reason? If you come home and kick the cat, you just ain't happy, guy. Well, unless you just really get something out of kicking cats. In other words, if you're not being fulfilled in your work, find the kind of work that you need to find to get that fulfillment. Say, well, yeah, but Pastor, you don't understand. I can't afford to go to college. There's not a single thing that you can do that requires college. I have talked to medical doctors and asked them this question. In fact, and I say medical doctors, I mean medical doctor requires what, 12 years of school plus residency and so forth. Medical doctors, how long would it take you to teach me, not everything you know, but to teach me what you do on a day-in, day-out basis? And invariably, whether a person is a carpenter or whether he's a medical doctor, the answer is always 6 months. I can teach you everything you need to know to do my job. You won't necessarily understand it. You won't know everything that I know, but you'll be able to get to work in the morning and do most of what I do in the course of a day after 6 months. That means that virtually everything could be taught by apprenticeships. And the reason we've done away with apprenticeships is because we've fallen in love with college degrees. And don't talk to me, I have a buku bunch of them myself. But we've fallen in love with them, and what we really want is not a degree, what we really want is training. We want to know how to do what we can find fulfillment in doing. I think that there is a tremendous future. I'm not sure how it would work. This is not my dream. But it's an idea. And if it becomes your dream, run with it. To have a Christian vo-tech school that includes apprenticeships that teach you how to do anything you want to do and you can go to work and start drawing a paycheck after 6 months. That's not to say you're going to be as good as you're ever going to be. I know carpenters that are joiners after 15, 20 years, and they're still learning how to perfect their craft. Well, don't you think that's probably also true of brain surgeons? Sure, you're going to get better and better and better over time. That's true. But I'm talking about 6 months, basically, just to where you can start drawing a paycheck and supporting a family. Starting a business. Are you going to get all of the business at first? No. At first, you're going to get people who either don't have a doctor or who don't feel that bad. Don't have insurance. And one of the things that keeps that from happening, two things keeps it from happening. What are they? Government licensure and trade unions. The trade unions basically have the apprenticeships locked up, don't they? So the deep desire, men have a deep desire to do fulfilling work. And most people have a hard time taking extended breaks from their work. If you're really doing something that you enjoy doing, it's going to be hard for you to use up all your vacation time. I mean, I know right now, some of you right now, you're saying, man, the reason I want to get ahead is so I can get some vacation. That's because you haven't spent 6 months on vacation. You spend 6 months on vacation, you're going to be chomping at the bit to get back. And then another thing I want us to understand is that men love to work when they are working at something that gives them, gives their life, gives their family a purpose. We're talking purpose-driven again, aren't we? Well, there's more to purpose than just purpose-driven, but we do need to have an understanding that there's more to life than just getting up in the morning, working all day, and going to bed, that there is something at the end of the trail. When man was created to work, he was created to produce wealth. Now, there you go. Producing wealth requires work. Now, not all work produces wealth, but all production of wealth does require work, either on your part or somebody that you can talk into doing it for you. Right? Well, how did the captains of industry become the captains of industry? Because they found out they can make more money if they had more hands involved, right? So now they're making money with other people's hands as well as with their own. So you can work without producing wealth, but you can't produce wealth without work. Can't happen. Where's it going to come from? It's not going to drop out of the sky. It's not going to come in on a parachute. Somebody's going to have to work. Now, man was given what we might call raw resources or natural resources. Look around you. There they are. The dirt in the ground, that stuff that used to ooze out of the ground here in Texas. We burned it all. But that stuff that used to ooze out of the ground here in Texas, that just got in the way of the farmers. The farmers hated that stuff until we found out that you could refine it and put it in internal combustion engines. Up until that time, sure, we had to have light, but there were enough whales in the world that we could just keep on reducing their blubber to whale oil, and that kept our lamps lit. Natural gas kept our lamps lit. We didn't need the oil. When we started using oil was when we found out that we could refine it and make internal combustion engines go. And someday we're going to use up all the oil, to which I say, okay, we'll find something else to burn. You know, there's lots of flammable stuff out there. We'll just burn something else. Everything has some hydrogen in it. And hydrogen burns fairly clean, I mean, compared to oil. Well, look around. That's the point. We have lots of natural resources. I've said this before. You know, if the Lord should do something that prevented me being in the ministry tomorrow, I'd just grab a bag of rocks and sell them to somebody who's building something. You know, it's all just stuff that was laying there, And then somebody figured out that they could build something out of it. They could make something out of it. They could turn it into something else. They could make it such that somebody else wanted it now. Right? I had it. I did something to it. Now somebody else wants it more than I want to keep it. What that's called is turning natural resources into sellable product. So here's what we have to add. We take the stuff. And what is stuff? It's just creation. Raw natural material, raw material resources. Here's what we do, is we take that stuff, we add ingenuity, time, and talent, and I can take these resources and turn them into a multitude of goods that are going to serve people in all different circumstances of life. I can take grass and turn it into a wool sweater. In fact, I can take nitrogen fertilizer and turn it into a wool sweater. What do you think about that? How many of you think I'm lying? No, I'm not. You think I'm lying? Okay. I just want to know how you're going to do it. Because one thing is, you know, the knitting needles would never go around the little particles of fertilizer, would it? What are we doing with fertilizer? We're causing the grass to grow. What are the sheep going to do? They're going to eat the grass. And then what's going to happen on the sheep's bodies? They're going to produce a coat of wool. Then we shear the sheep of the wool, card the wool, spin the wool, and then knit the wool into a sweater. We've just turned fertilizer into a sweater, haven't we? But wait a minute. Where'd the fertilizer come from? Well, it's some kind of a nitrogen product. It's the casting off of the sheep, right? It's basically sheep stool, right? Isn't that where the fertilizer came from? So now the sheep are giving back what I needed to make wool sweaters. So I take, it's just ingenuity. And if my sheep quit making sweaters for me, I eat them. So here's what we do. It takes ingenuity, it takes time, and it takes talent. And it probably takes some degree of education, training. Let's call it training instead of education. So time, talent, and training. We put those things together, and we turn raw materials into products that people want. I use the example of a sweater, but how many of you would love to have a boat? Okay, I can turn fertilizer into boats. Okay, sheep stool into boats. It'll take me a little bit longer because now instead of just growing grass, I have to grow some trees. But I can turn sheep stool into boats. So you want a boat? There you go. How many of you want a diamond? Okay, I can't do that with fertilizer. First, you have to let me kill a forest and wait. Yeah, or find a machine that will put that charcoal under extreme pressure. And guess what we're going to have? A rock that your wife would love to have on her finger. It's still a rock, right? You know, it's carved so the light hits it pretty, but it's still a rock. We're just changing the shape and the form. That's producing wealth. How much are sheep droppings worth? I'm not asking for a market quotation. I'm just pointing out that they can't be that expensive, but we can turn them into boats. We can turn them into rocks. We can turn them into diamonds. We can turn them into sweaters. Ingenuity, time, talent, training. And that produces wealth. So when man was created to work, he was created to produce wealth. Now, man cannot create something out of nothing. God can, but we can't. Remember, in the beginning, God created everything else that's not God. God can create out of nothing. He started with nothing as his raw materials and ended up with everything. Out of nothing, ex nihilo, N-I-H-I-L-O. It just means creation out of nothing. God can do that. We can't. But here's what we can do. We can refashion the creation in such a way as to make that creation either more useful to us or more useful to our neighbor or both. By the way, I can also turn sheep droppings into paper for you to take notes on, right? The benefits that accrue to a man and to his neighbor when measured by God's standard, then, what are we going to do? We're going to take raw materials, we're going to add time, talent, and training, we're going to refashion them in such a way that we create something in a different form. It didn't used to be that way. And when we finish up, it's going to be more useful to ourselves or to our neighbor or both. How can we tell? Because the neighbor's willing to buy it from us. In other words, wealth is just a way of keeping score as to how well you're doing at serving people. How many of you wrote that down? Wealth is a way of keeping score of how well you're doing at serving others. And when we do this according to God's standard of right and wrong, we create wealth. Wealth is the product of labor and ingenuity applied to God's basic creation. Okay? Labor and ingenuity. In other words, time, talent, training. We're going to apply that to God's basic creation. Now, we can add tools to this, but there's no need to, because tools are simply the result of the excess wealth that we've made before now. In other words, tools are simply a way of storing wealth as an investment in the future. We're going to talk about that next time. Well, maybe not next time, but next presentation. We're going to talk about how the first thing you want to invest your money in is not CDs. It's not in CDs, certificates of deposit. It's not in long-term treasury bills. The first thing you want to invest your money in is a set of tools. You say, well, what kind of tools should I get? What kind of work are you doing? You should get a set of tools that are commensurate with the kind of work you're doing. Does that make sense? If you're in the sweater business, that would be knitting needles. And once you've sold enough sweater and you've accumulated enough wealth, you get yourself a knitting machine that runs on steam or falling water or electricity, which is generated by steam or falling water. So we add capital or tools to this definition, but it should be obvious that capital is itself a product of previous generations who have properly applied the basic formula of labor plus ingenuity times resources. Labor plus ingenuity is that old guy, time, talent, training. We apply that to resources, we produce wealth. Or we produce mud pies. You have to know what people want. You have to be ready to serve people with it. So wealth is the product, we're still under production of wealth. Wealth is the product of labor and ingenuity applied to God's basic creation. Wealth, in other words, has its origin in the creation mandate. What is the creation mandate? Be fruitful and multiply, take dominion over the earth. It has its origin in the creation mandate, and as such, is not something to be despised, but something that we cannot escape. The biblical view of wealth is this. We are commanded to create wealth. And the penalty for not creating wealth has a name. Poverty. The penalty for not creating wealth is poverty. The difficulty we have in this country is that over a period of generations, we were so good at producing wealth that now we can live on that excess for a number of years until we've gotten so lazy we don't know how to produce wealth anymore. So wealth and its creation are fundamental to our essential humanity. Okay? If you want to be truly human, create wealth. Now, wealth is a human product, but it is not easy to produce the social conditions for wealth to accumulate. Making money is easy if you've got the right social conditions. What's hard is getting the right social conditions, because you have to have, what's the key word? Freedom. You have to be free to create and then keep your wealth. You know, if every time we get our barley crop about to come in, the Turks come down out of the hills and steal all of our barley, pretty soon that's going to just really disincentivize us to grow anything. Discourage us from growing barley. So you have to be able to keep the product of your hands, the product of your endeavors, if you're going to create wealth. You have to be able to keep it. You have to be able to create it. So now, it's even more difficult to create the conditions under which wealth can continue to accumulate beyond one person's lifetime. As hard as it is to create the conditions to accumulate wealth during your lifetime, it's even harder to create the conditions that will allow you to accumulate it over numbers of generations. That's why it's so difficult to have a multi-generational vision, or vice versa. Now, we have an enemy in this country right now that we have to do away with as soon as we possibly can, and that's the death tax. That makes it absolutely impossible to accumulate wealth beyond a certain level over more than one generation's time. And the government basically can pass a law anytime it wants to and change what that level is. You can say, no problem, I haven't reached the level yet. And the government passes a law, and yes, you have. That's the trouble with living in a tyranny. Even if it is a tyranny by, I don't know, who are those guys? Elected officials? Yeah. So, in order for us to get this right, we have to have the right religious viewpoint. This is where I'm going with this. If we're going to accumulate wealth over multiple generations, we have to have the right religious viewpoint. If we have the wrong religious viewpoint, it will become impossible for a society to have the conditions necessary to accumulate wealth. Here's what I mean by that. This is going to bring us into the Reformation. Okay, so now we're going to talk about the Reformation just a little bit. I'm going to try not to bore you too much, because this is, after all, history. But I think it's valuable history, history that will serve you well. Go all the way back to the year 1053. Say, man, that was before most of us were even born. There was a major split, a schism between between the Eastern Church and the Western Church. And the Eastern Church literally has not changed in 1,000 years. The things that they're doing today in the Russian Orthodox and Greek Orthodox and Armenian churches today are the same things that they were doing 1,000 years ago, and more than 1,000 years. The East, in fact, prides itself in being unchanging, semper eadem, in its unchanging literature. Now, what's the result of that? The result of that is you champion the status quo, right? You all know what status quo is? The state that now is. If you don't want things to change, you're basically saying, I like things just the way they are. And I'm going to fight anybody who wants to change anything in any way. The West also has its liturgy. Liturgy simply means its form of worship, rooted in the first century. The Western Church, now we're part of the Western Church, but it was more open to adaptations. And the result of being open to adaptations is theological growth and development. Two things about the Eastern Church you should know. There has never been a Reformation, and they have never written a systematic theology. They have never written a systematic theology in the Eastern Church because they don't think systematically. They don't think in a logical, linear, Western way. And that's because we got Augustine and they got Chrysostom. It's just two different ways of thinking. In the West, we've been open to theological growth and development, and theological growth and development has led to cultural and sociological growth and progress. It's because we have a Reformation, it's because we have a Western theology, first of all, that there's been any progress, any growth. And by the way, where has all the growth been for the last 1,000 years? Something else that we're getting away from church history a little bit here, but another significant thing happened right after 1053. Does the year 1066 mean anything to anybody? 1066. Johnny? What is the Battle of Hastings? Exactly right. The Battle of Hastings in 1066 basically kept England from going Danish. And I'm not talking about that breakfast pastry. If William the Bastard had not defeated England in 1066, they would have become Vikings. They were well on their way to becoming Vikings. And in 1066, William the Conqueror, we call him, when William the Conqueror basically brought Western progress back to England and, you know, re-Christianized or de-piratized England. England was very rapidly, because of the Norsemen, even the language at that time was becoming more and more and more Norse. And that's why you have two words for everything. Have you ever noticed in English that we have two words for everything? Hug is the old English. Embrace is the word that we use because of the Battle of Hastings. So anyway, the Battle of Hastings is an important date in history because it opens up, the English Empire began in 1066. Granted, it was tiny, it was nascent, but it was destined for greatness. And we are now the heirs to the British Empire. I know some of you are saying, empire, I don't know about empire. What's going on in Iraq if that's not empire? Isn't that empire? Do we have any national interests in Iraq? Or do we just get political? Sorry. The 16th century Reformation then followed that. And with the 16th Reformation, we had one social advancement after another. The church, up until that time, had become infected with unbiblical ideas and practices. Basically, you had power concentrated into a clergy elite. The money was all going to Rome. God raised men in that environment. God raised up men who used the Bible as their guide. Remember, moral choices have to get back to what standard? God's standard. So in the 16th century, from 1517 up through about 1564, the death of Calvin, God raised up numerous men in Northern Europe that brought about a change of thinking so that everything goes back to the Bible now. Now, this held back the advance of humanism in the church for about 4 centuries. Humanism in the church has really just now reared its ugly head again. But for 400 years, humanism was kept at bay by the Reformation. And here's how. the Reformers viewed every man in creation as being directly responsible to God without any mediator save Christ Himself as prophet, priest, and king. You say, well, that's not so revolutionary. I've heard that all my life. Yeah, you have. But 500 years, people hadn't. 500 years ago, people hadn't. This view of man as prophet, priest, and king basically now frees up man's labor and ingenuity in a way never before witnessed in all of history. Now that I'm responsible directly to God, I'm working for Him. You know, basically, what's my calling? I'm Jesus' assistant. What's your calling? You're Jesus' assistant. All of us have a calling directly under God to do whatever it is that we've been called to do. And that means that neither civil government nor ecclesiastical government, that's just a fancy word for church government, neither civil nor church government could bind men's consciences, but God alone was seen to be the Lord of the conscience through His Word alone. Only the Bible can tell us what's right and what's wrong. Some man in Rome or some man in Atlanta cannot tell us what's right and wrong. Only God can do that. And He does that by His Word. This freed up the human spirit to find its purpose. From where? Not from other men, but from divine revelation. And now I can do all my creating. When I add my time, my talent, and my training to natural resources, I can do it all to the glory of God. Now, if you really believed, and I hope you do, if you really believed that everything you were doing had an impact on the way the world views God, how creative would you be? Yeah. How hard would you work? How much would you train? How many tools would you want to accumulate? How much capital would you want to pass on to the next generation? You see how mind-bogglingly liberating this is? The spirit of man is now free to communicate directly with God. What should I do? When should I do it? How should I do it? How much? How high? And a person's highest calling then was seen to be to serve God in everything that he did. Now, I'm not just tightening down the number 9 bolt at General Dynamics anymore. Now I'm building airplanes for Jesus. It's a whole different mindset, isn't it? It's a whole... GD. Lockheed. I'm sorry. They're not GD anymore, are they? Okay, how many of you even remember when Lockheed was... Never mind. Okay, what two of us do. Yeah, I used to make a living over there at General Dynamics, but now it's Lockheed. So, a person's highest calling, now he's over there building F-16s, he's still tightening down that number 9 bolt, he's still popping that number 9 rivet, whatever it is he's doing over there at Lockheed, but now, instead of just drudgery and doing the same thing over again, he's building airplanes for God. Now that's inspiring, isn't it? That's why this Reformation concept of calling just exploded with Western wealth. So once freed from civil and ecclesiastical tyranny, man's period of greatest progress began. From the Reformation until now has been the most productive 500 years in the entire history of mankind. But not everywhere in the world. Only in the countries where the Reformation took place and those countries that are willing to follow the Reformation example. In other words, you can do the right thing even for the wrong reasons and still make a little bit of stuff. Let me recommend a couple things for you to read. Both of these are still in print. One is called The Religious Tradesman by Richard Steele. It was originally published in the late 17th century under the title The Tradesman's Calling. But basically, here's what he's saying, is the same thing I'm telling you right now, is that every calling is religious. Every calling is from God. And He goes so far as to say, especially the tradesmen. Well, we would say today, see, tradesmen, we think of drywall and the construction trades. But when he says tradesmen, what he's thinking of is shopkeepers. And remember, most of the Puritans were what? What were the Puritans before they came here? Where'd they make their money? How'd they save up enough money to buy Massachusetts? Most of them were shopkeepers. Most of them, the Puritans invented the middle class. And what they said is, we may start out poor, but if we create enough wealth, we can buy Massachusetts. And so they did. The Reformation also brought about a revival of optimism. And I don't mean by that just, well, everything will turn out. I'm talking about a revival of future orientation. When we're oriented, now listen, you think about this with me. If we really believed that Jesus were going to come back next Tuesday, how much of your time, talent, and training would you invest in something that's not going to pay off until your grandchildren's day? None, because after all, after Tuesday, there ain't nothing left. Right? Well, around the year 1000, everybody was expecting Christ to return. And basically, production just fell to zip. With the advent of the Reformation, people again became future-oriented via a system of Bible interpretation that we call postmillennialism. That's not going to be on the test. Don't worry about it. But postmillennialism basically says the future belongs to God and His people. It doesn't have a calendar like the pre-mills do. But we basically say this, that the future belongs to God and to His people. It belongs to those who are willing to plan for it. So, future orientation. It transformed all of Western Europe, and the whole world has benefited from it. According to standard Reformation thinking, the whole world would be subdued to the kingdom of Christ and bow before the King of Kings. That is postmillennialism in a nutshell. Optimism of this kind is unique to Christianity. Only Christianity can create this kind of optimism, but it's also borrowed many times by other religions, such as communism and now Islamofascism. Do you know how they're able to get people to blow themselves up? Because they think if they do, their kids are going to be better off. In other words, they're oriented toward the future. Now, their answer is horrendous. Their answer of terrorism is horrendous. For more reasons than one, it can't win. Terrorism can't win. The most it can do is make us give up. If we give up, then they win regardless of the tactics they used. Right? But terrorism can't win a war. How can it? Well, it can't. But what it can do is rob us of the will to win. And if you pay any attention to the newspapers at all, you know that's what's happening, right? I mean, Democrat, Schmemocrat, I don't care what they call themselves. If they're in Congress and they want to turn the world over to jihadists, they've lost the will to win. When people believe that what they do now will be a future benefit to themselves and their posterity, they plan, work, and think differently from those who have no vision of the future. And you see, only Christianity has a coherent, cohesive view of the future. We call it eschatology. That's just a big fancy word for we believe the future is yet to come. Okay, in economic terms, this worldview manifests itself in programs for the future. This involves people in what we call saving or investment. If the world is about to end and Christ is about to rapture away the church from the earth, it makes no sense to think about or talk about the future of the church on the earth. But such things as take time and resources, such things as require planning and ingenuity, require future orientation as well. This revival emphasis of the Reformation, preaching, challenged men to labor for the kingdom of God in their own callings. You see, here's what you have after the Reformation began. You have just an explosion of sermon material on things like family, manhood, vocation, various aspects of daily life. You have sermons by the Puritans. The Puritans were especially good about bringing the Scriptures to bear on everyday life so that you could know what God wants you to do on Tuesday as well as Sunday. And Christians began discussing seriously perplexing problems. Say that 14 times. They began discussing these things seriously, like prophets, what they are, prices, what they are. How many of you think that the seller sets the price of goods? Oh, you knew that was a trick question, didn't you? Who sets the price of goods? The buyer. Because as long as he's unwilling to pay that price, it sits on the shelf. Until the seller lowers his price by means of sales, right? President's Day, sales, until rebates. He keeps lowering his price until what happens? The buyer says, okay, at that price, I'll buy it. Christians began discussing these things, prophets, what they are, prices, what they are, what conditions are necessary for wealth production. And basically the Puritans said, you know what, we're never going to change England enough to produce all the wealth we want here. We're going to have to go someplace else. And you know what the first thing they did when they got here was? They started producing wealth and conserving wealth. Say, well, now, wait a minute. I read about those pilgrims, and those pilgrims were down to about 11 grains of corn a day in their rations. I don't think they did that well. That's true. The first winter, they didn't have very much. But after all, they got here in October. How much time was there? But starting the next year, they realized, you know what? This communism idea just ain't working. We need to divide things up and start each man producing his own stuff. And after that happened, what happened? Look around you. This is what happened. They came here for the purpose of showing that God has a better way of doing things. And then they proceeded to do things a better way. God's work, God's way. Historian Alden Vaughan says this, Puritanism, and I'm adding this part, Puritanism is nothing but consistently biblical Christianity. Don't let the name Puritanism drive you away. H.L. Mencken had it all wrong. The Puritans were among the most joyous people who ever lived. You could hardly get them to stop laughing. Seriously, this idea of the old dour Puritan, that's just false. Puritanism had political, economic, and social manifestations as well because it required of its adherents a number of convictions about the role of government, the nature of work, and family relationships, which in both tangible and intangible ways reshaped their lives. Subscription to Puritan theology imposed upon the believer an obligation to live every part of his life in accordance with Holy Writ. And Holy Writ, if carefully searched, would be found sufficient for most occasions. And what was true, the Puritan believed, what was true for the individual was also assumed to be true of a Puritan, and they would have said Christian, society. In other words, everything we need to know about how to build a Christian society, we can find in the pages of Scriptures if we'll look for it diligently. That's what the Puritans were saying. I agree. Prophets. Thought we'd never get here. Stewardship of resources and activities that benefit our fellow men are Christian in origin. That's just review, right? Saving and investment for long-term projects also reflect a Christian attitude of building the future. We've already reviewed that. Proverbs 13:22a says, a good man leaveth an inheritance to his children's children. If the government does something to keep you from leaving an inheritance to your grandchildren, then they're doing something wicked because they're preventing you from being good. Right? Okay, this ain't rocket science. Even in today's post-Christian culture, we can find the remnants of activities that reflect this godly heritage. Saving implies that something is left over after we've taken out of our income what is necessary for living in the present. Okay, you can't save anything till you have more than you need. If you have to borrow from the bank each month in order to have enough to live on, you're never going to save anything. You have to produce more than you spend in order to save. Now, the accountant refers to these leftovers as profits, though economists have a somewhat different definition. An economist will call it surplus, and not all surplus is true profits because part of it must be utilized as retained earnings. And the retained earnings are used to expand the business, buying new tools. Without surplus, however, there can be no advancement economically. Now, this is true individually, but it's also true of a culture. It's also true of a society. A society must produce more than it consumes for that society to advance economically. That means that we have a responsibility in a Christian society, in a Christian culture, of producing those conditions that are necessary for wealth. We talked about that last time. Drucker said, economic advance depends on the ability of an economy to form capital. That is, to have enough money left over to generate a surplus of current production over the costs of the past and the present. There has to be a surplus in order to make progress. So here's my translation of Drucker. If one must spend all his resources providing food and shelter for the present, there will not be time for capital creation to develop tools to help him in the future. If you have to spend all your time just to make enough money to eat, you're never going to have anything left over to make or buy tools. And remember, capitalism requires tools. We reject the labor theory of value. That's communistic to the core. We maintain that value comes from people wanting stuff. Profit is so far from being the result of greed and exploitation that it is the necessary ingredient that permits economic activity and economic advancement to take place. There has to be profit for advancement to happen. As Christians, we should then be doing all in our power to further profits. Because without profits, there can be no savings. Without savings, there can be no capital formation. And without capital formation, there cannot be a healthy and an advancing economy. So did you see how that chain works? We have to have profits. That's the first step. Now, here's what that means, guys. You can't spend everything you make. You know the old saw, right? If your outgo exceeds your income, your upkeep becomes your downfall. That's right. And what we're saying there is you have to have profits in order to advance the ball, in order to move the economy forward. Rather than frowning on profits as such, Christians should be concerned about the manner in which profits are accrued and used. Is it possible to make profits wickedly? Yes, it is. Although he didn't profit in the end, for a while, Achan profited by that gold wedge and those silver shekels, right? For a short while. Biblically, we call this idea of how to make profits stewardship. And that is the correct attitude, given the fact that we're God's image, living in His universe, and using the things He has created as resources. If it's His universe, He made it all the stuff belongs to God, then what are we? In the final analysis, we're stewards, aren't we? Okay, I think I've talked past your attention span. Can we do just a few more slides and we'll be finished? Wealth as such is not the goal of the Christian. Okay? Wealth as such is not the goal of the Christian. If it were, any means of accruing that wealth would do. Right? Me just clubbing you in the head when you're not looking and taking your money would be a way of me increasing my wealth. So, just the accruing of wealth, the gaining of wealth, is not the end for Christians. Rather, we maintain that it is the direct outcome of obedience to God's commands. Some of you aren't writing. Have I gone past your attention span? What's going on? You're just done writing. Okay. You're out of ink. Okay. Here's what I'm saying. If you obey God, the direct outcome of your obedience is the creation of wealth. That is to say, if you have a concept of calling, if you regard your work as being to the glory of God, if you're doing everything that you do for His glory, for His declarative glory, so people will see how glorious and majestic and marvelous and generous God is, the outcome of that kind of work, of that kind of attitude, is the creation of wealth. Now, that's not a prosperity gospel. That's just how the world works. Man was made to work, and as he does so, he progresses economically. In short, men get wealth in accordance with Deuteronomy 8:18. Have you ever heard Deuteronomy 8:18 quoted in this church before? Okay. But thou shalt remember the Lord thy God, for it is He that giveth thee power to get wealth with this purpose, that He may establish His covenant which He sware unto thy fathers as it is this day. God has a purpose for making you wealthy, and that is to establish His covenant. If you get wealthy for any other reason, you're going to ruin your life and the life of your children and the life of your children's children on downward. You say, well, no, they'll still be rich. Yes, they'll still be rich for a while. Do you know the one thing harder than creating wealth? Keeping it. And basically what your children, you'll leave it to a fool if you get it some other way or for some other purpose. It is the severing of wealth from its right purpose that provided the environment for many critics of wealth creation. And who am I thinking of? Ron Sider, for example. How many of you have read a book called Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger by Ron Sider? Well, don't bother. Don't bother. It's claptrap. In fact, if you want to read a book along that line, read Wealthy Christians in an Age of Guilt Manipulators by David Chilton. Different Chilton from the guy that does the car repair manuals. This modern hostility toward profits comes from hostility toward God, or a wrong view of God and envy of one's neighbors. And a distinguishing mark of modern society is the belief that we can live without reference to God. Who would disagree with that? Isn't that the very nature of postmodernism? Is that we can live without any reference to God. Now, that's atheism, isn't it? But if the typical Christian goes home Sunday night after church and lives Monday through Saturday without reference to God, doesn't that make him an atheist 6 days a week? I put it to you that the only way that we can create wealth for the right purpose is to understand God's covenant and have a multi-generational point of view. The creation and use of wealth for ongoing development are encouraged by Scripture. Here's a list of Scriptures. If you don't jot anything else down, you might want to jot down the references. That I may cause those that love me to inherit substance, and I will fill their treasuries. You like that one? Proverbs 8:21. Wealth gotten by vanity shall be diminished, but he that gathereth by labor shall increase. What is that saying? Get rich quick schemes will make somebody else rich, not you. Every man, Ecclesiastes 5:19, one of my favorites. Every man also to whom God hath given riches and wealth, and hath given him power to eat thereof, and to take his portion, and to rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God. Now, does that sound to you like something horrendous that we should hate? That we should avoid? That we should say, oh, this is so dangerous. Only a few people can handle this kind of wealth. Well, then let's train more to handle that kind of wealth. If it requires religious training, and it does, then let's start discipling people. Only instead of discipling them to poverty, let's disciple them to wealth. What do you think? You know what? It doesn't take any effort at all to disciple people to poverty. All you have to do is say, stay home today. You know, God loves you more when you're sitting at home reading the Bible than He does when you're out laboring trying to create wealth for His kingdom. You should spend more time praying. After all, well, sure, because prayer is what God likes. Prayer doesn't want you out. God doesn't want you out just making that filthy lucre. He wants you to spend your time in the monastery. He wants you to spend your time. Haven't you heard things like that? Am I making false accusations? That's not what Ecclesiastes 5:19 teaches. Ecclesiastes 5:19 teaches when you got a bunch of good stuff, that's because God gave it to you. Then thou shalt see, Isaiah 60, verse 5, then thou shalt see and flow together, and thine heart shall fear and be enlarged, because the abundance of the sea shall be converted unto thee. The forces of the Gentiles shall come unto thee. I think this is a prediction of the day that we're going to start farming the oceans. And it's coming. Maybe not tomorrow, maybe not next week, but as fertilizer gets more and more expensive, the price of a barrel of oil nudged $80 this week. Did you know that? A barrel of oil, a barrel of crude, nudged 80 bucks. I'm not going to say it hit 85. It didn't. It just barely nudged 80. But think about that for a moment, because a year ago we were talking about the sky-high price of oil at $60 a barrel. And now it's a third again higher. A year later, think that through. We may end up having to farm the oceans. But if we end up having to farm the oceans, I want to be the firstest with the mostest. I want to be out there staking my claim on an ocean farm. And what will we raise? I don't know. Kelp? I don't know what we'll raise, but I know this. It won't be wheat. We'll have some product that we'll be raising in the oceans that people can eat, and because of the price of fertilizer being tied to the price of oil, that may be happening sooner than we think. You have to be able to see the future to live in the future. So, are a lot of people going to lose money on oil at $80 a barrel? Yes. And even more are going to make money because oil went to $80 a barrel. How many of you own any stock right now in the whale oil companies? Oh, that's right, there aren't any more whale oil companies. Do you know why? I can tell you in one word. Petroleum. Okay, here we go. How much time do we have left back there? Okay. Disciple a man's imagination with faulty views of wealth and its creation is an unnecessary and unbiblical limitation on man's personality and his ability to function as the image of God. However, sad to say, the history of economics is one in which many forget God their Creator once they have accumulated wealth. When men worship money instead of God, it becomes a god called mammon. However, this is not an argument against wealth. It's not an argument against the creation of wealth. It's not an argument against the possession of wealth. It's only an argument against the worship of wealth. It is at best a reminder that we must guard against complacency and the false idea that the wealth we have at our disposal is our own creation and does not ultimately come from God. Another mistake is to think that the purpose of our wealth can be found in our own selfish desires. James informs us that we do not get what we ask for because we want it for the wrong reasons or motives. If you want wealth for the wrong reason or motive, that might be the very reason you're not getting it. When our dreams are self-centered rather than God-centered, this fact, more than any other one thing, tells us why many of us do not have the amount of wealth we'd like to have. Because your dream is centered on you and not on the kingdom of God. If your dream were centered on the kingdom of God, listen to this. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. How many of you have memorized that verse? Good. How many of you believe it? Well, a few of you. Think about it. Here's what Jesus is saying there. If your goals and dreams, your ambitions are all God-centered, kingdom-centered, there will be no stopping you. Everything you need will be given to you to accomplish that goal. Am I misunderstanding in there? Man was created with a purpose to work and to make economic progress. This is our purpose. Our greatest calling in life is therefore to work and to help our fellow man in his work. The modern revolt against work and against profit is at root a revolt against God. And our investments, that is our time and our tools, should be organized with a view to these truths. That is, centered on productive activities where the capital can be used for real growth and development. That's next time. How do we do that? I keep it within 80 minutes? Great, let's stand and be dismissed with prayer.
You have been listening to a sermon by Dr. Richard Bacon of Faith Presbyterian Church Reformed in Mesquite, Texas. For more information on FPCR Ministries, visit our website at www.fpcr.org or contact us by mail at 6702 Dalrock Road, Suite 126, PMB 214, Rowlett, Texas, 75089.